This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janat Jalil, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 2nd of July, these are our main stories. There have been more clashes in France hours after the funeral of the teenager whose death at the hands of police sparked nationwide riots. The head of the CIA says unhappiness with Russia's leadership has given the United States a once-in-a-generation opportunity to recruit spies. Twitter's owner Elon Musk has announced temporary limits on the number of posts users can read each day. Also in this podcast...
The Gay Pride Festival in Seoul is first and foremost a celebration. All around me are people dressed in rainbow colours.
Tens of thousands of people in South Korea have taken part in the annual Pride Parade, one of the largest in Asia. We begin in France. As we record this podcast, tens of thousands of police have again been deployed in cities across France after four nights of rioting. On Saturday, the funeral was held of 17-year-old Nael, whose killing by a police officer on Tuesday sparked the violence which has seen hundreds of buildings set on fire and hundreds of businesses looted. The sale of fireworks and inflammable liquids has now been banned. Amid fears of a fifth night of violence, videos on social media appear to show clashes in the southern port city of Marseille. So as regards the mood in France on a Saturday night in summer and the current stance of the police, the BBC's Hugh Schofield has more.
You know, at the moment, it's just firefighting in a kind of metaphorical sense. All they can do is be tough with these riots and wait till it dies down. It will die down, but we don't know when. And it may be that it does require some drastic psychological kind of kick, like a state of emergency, to bring about that moment. I mean, at some point, the rioters are going to tire and there'll be a kind of return to the old normal. But it's not going to be tonight. You know, it's the weekend now. It's the night of the funeral. You know, the worst of it is it's a summer, the long, long evenings, Schools are breaking up. This evening already down in Marseille, we're hearing of things kicking off on the Canebière. That's the road that leads down to the old port. So, yeah, I mean, everyone presumes that tonight is going to be a bad night as well.
Hugh Schofield. So, as we said, the French Arab teenager Nael has been laid to rest. Hundreds of people turned out for his funeral in the Paris suburb of Nanterre, where he was shot dead. Some rode scooters alongside the hearse as it drove from a mosque to a nearby cemetery.
Justice for Nael! Justice for Nael!
Many shouted, "Justice for Nael!" Our Paris correspondent, Lucy Williamson, reports on the funeral.
Beside the discreet barricades outside the cemetery in Nanterre, a small crowd waited for Nael's funeral cortege. There was more tension than talking. All filming, even on phones, was banned. No Snapchat, no Insta, mourners were told. The message to journalists was starker. Get a camera out at your peril. Public interest in Nael grating against more private ties. One woman, who wasn't at the funeral, told us she knew Nael a little. She didn't want to be identified. She said the violence triggered by his death was unhelpful.
Burning everything, schools, town halls, it's useless. Everything they're doing, the parents will pay the price. But if there are riots, it's because the police are looking for it. When they check young people's IDs 10 times a day, it's irritating.
The prayers in Nanterre were for Nael. At night, the demands of some here are for justice. The prayers of others are for peace.
Lucy Williamson in Paris. Police unions in France have warned that their members are close to exhaustion. In some areas, they say tear gas and other supplies used in crowd control are running low. All week, the BBC has been inviting representatives of the French police to speak to us, so far with no luck. But the main police union, the Alliance Police Nationale, did send us a statement on Saturday. Here's part of it.
That's enough now. Faced with these savage hordes, asking for calm is no longer enough. We must impose it. Our colleagues, like the majority of citizens, can no longer endure the diktats of these violent minorities. Today, the police are in combat mode because we're at war. Tomorrow, we resist and the government will have to take heed.
My colleague Rebecca Kesby spoke to Professor Sebastian Roche, who's research director at the French National Centre for Scientific Research. He specialises in comparative policing research, particularly policing minority groups and the use of weapons. She asked him first for his take on how the police have handled the violence over the past few days.
The difficulty is that the police are at the origin of the largest crisis of the last 15 years, because they have shot a young boy that was not a threat to the police officer who decided to take that shot. But on the same hand, since the riot have begun, we have seen a quite moderate approach from the government side and from the police side. There is a show of force, 40,000 officers on the street. We have armored vehicles on the street, police officers with warlike weapons, rifles, not only handguns, and also rubber bullet guns, etc. But they use them very, if I may say, sort of smoothly. I mean, there has nobody has been shot by the police.
Well, okay, yeah. You say moderate. They have arrested well over 1,000 people. And I just want to draw your attention to this rather combative press statement we've had from the Alliance Police Nationale. This is the primary police union today. They've said they're facing savage hordes. Asking for calm is no longer enough. We must impose it. They say today the police are in combat mode because we're at war. I mean, is that the right kind of tone to be setting to try and calm things down?
No, I mean, the President of the Republic, Prime Minister, Minister of Interior, they have one line of language. They try to be moderate, but the police unions in France, they are closer to the extreme right, the Rassemblement National. We are talking about rioting in the banlieue, and that's where a lot of people with foreign origin live. They consider them as pests, I'm quoting. Yeah?
Right.
So they have a very harsh language, and it could be seen as some sort of an incitement to civil war.
I mean, when you put that on top of the fact that this is the third fatal shooting at a traffic stop this year alone, there were 13 last year fatal shootings at traffic stops, which presumably are fairly routine affairs all over the world, in fact. But why are they becoming fatal so often? I mean, what's going wrong with policing?
No, the French police looks really bad. We have systemic discrimination against minority group. And now we have, since 2017, we have a 5- to 6-fold increase in the number of lethal shootings during traffic stops. So that's an incredibly bad situation. I think the French police is the champion of Europe when it comes to killings for traffic stops.
Professor Sebastian Roche from the French National Centre for Scientific Research. Well, President Macron has now postponed a state visit to Germany that was due to begin on Sunday to deal with this crisis, which comes after months of protests over his contested pension reforms. David Chazan, a reporter in Paris, told us more about the challenges the French president faces.
Trying to quell the rage on the streets appears to be gobbling up every bit of his attention. And he's relying on the police, but many of them are angry too. As they see it, he was too quick to condemn the officer accused of the shooting that triggered the chaos. I'm not sure they've all forgiven him for that yet, even though he's toughened what he's saying about the rioters. And now he's appealing to parents to keep teenagers at home and stop them joining the riots, but this is hardly a good look for a head of state, and it makes it easy for the far right and the far left, who are now the main opposition, to accuse him of weakness, of failing to come up with ideas. There's a sense that he's casting around for solutions, even that he's growing desperate. And President Macron is also hampered by his unpopularity after forcing through those hated pension reforms without a parliamentary vote.
David Chazan. Now to other news. The head of the US intelligence agency, the CIA, has said unhappiness in Russia over the invasion of Ukraine presents an opportunity to recruit more spies. William Burns told a gathering in Britain that disaffection was gnawing away at the Russian leadership. Here's our security correspondent, Gordon Carrera.
William Burns said the mutiny by Yevgeny Prigozhin's Wagner forces last Saturday was a vivid reminder of the corrosive effect of Putin's war on his own society and his own regime. He said that disaffection had created a once-in-a-generation opportunity for the CIA, referring to its role in recruiting human agents to provide intelligence. "We're not letting it go to waste. We are very much open for business," he added. A recent video in Russian telling people how to covertly contact the agency had 2.5 million views, he said. Mr. Burns did not directly address recent reports in the Washington Post that he made a secret visit to the Ukrainian capital shortly before the mutiny. It was reported that discussions with Ukrainian officials included the possibility that progress in their counteroffensive might open the way for peace negotiations from a position of greater strength if substantial territory was taken from Russia.
Gordon Carrera. Antonio Guterres has arrived in Haiti on his first visit as UN Secretary General in a bid to raise the alarm about the Caribbean nation, which has been racked by spiralling gang violence, even as it deals with political, economic and public health crises. Mr. Guterres urged the rest of the world not to forget the Western Hemisphere's poorest country. Leonardo Rocha reports.
The crisis has worsened since the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse 2 years ago. Last September, criminal gangs blockaded the fuel terminal for 6 weeks, bringing the economy to the verge of collapse. A month later, the UN proposed sending a rapid action force to help police restore order. But Mr. Guterres has failed so far to find support for his plan. The US, Canada and other major aid donors say the crisis will only be solved once Haiti's Prime Minister, Ariel Henry, sets a date for presidential and congressional elections.
Leonardo Rocha. To the South Korean capital now, where tens of thousands of people took part on Saturday in the annual Pride Parade, one of the largest in Asia. This comes as the LGBTQ community is continuing to fight for the right to same-sex marriage. It's illegal currently in South Korea, but Parliament is considering a bill to allow it. Michael Bristow sent this report from Seoul.
The Gay Pride Festival in Seoul is first and foremost a celebration. All around me are people dressed in rainbow colours. Some of them are wearing exotic costumes. There's even a few not wearing very much at all. All of them, though, welcome the growing diversity here in South Korean society.
It's important to showing us that we are existing here and we are being the citizens together. So I came out to here.
And are you having a good time?
Yeah, so happy!
We are not an invisible person and hope some find any lovers.
So you want to come here because you want to show that you're not invisible in South Korean society. Yeah. And you might want to find a lover too.
Yeah.
The people here also want change, specifically more legal protection for sexual minorities. And ultimately, they want the legalisation of same-sex marriages. But not everyone agrees. Just a few hundred metres away from the Gay Pride Festival, there's another rally, a rival one. This one's been organised by a coalition of churches in South Korea. They oppose the legalisation of same-sex marriages, and they're on the streets to make their voices heard.
We're here as Christians because the Korean government is trying to pass laws, allow homosexuals and gay marriages. And as Christians, we believe that homosexuality is a sin. And so we're here because they're doing a march, and so we're peacefully coming against that. As they are expressing their beliefs, we're also expressing our belief.
So which side's going to win in this battle over morals in South Korea? Some campaigners believe that it's only a matter of time before attitudes and then the law will change.
My name is Min-il Ryu. I'm an attorney here in South Korea and I'm working on many LGBT rights issues. Over the past 10 years, we already saw many progress from Korean society in terms of perception around LGBTQ people. Majority of Koreans, it's just they don't know anybody from LGBTQ population and they don't know how to think about the issue yet.
But she says more and more gay people are now coming out to friends, family and colleagues.
Before they were like, oh, I'm from conservative household, I don't know anybody. But now I know one colleague from my office. they actually came out to me because he feel confident that I will be much better colleague. You see a lot of this type of journey story from people who haven't decided on LGBT rights.
So here in the South Korean capital, we've had two very different rallies, two sets of people with opposing views of the world. All of them believe what they think passionately. It's not going to be easy to find common ground.
Michael Bristow with that report from Seoul. Meanwhile, in London, police arrested seven members of the Just Stop Oil protest group after they disrupted the annual Pride parade here. The activists sat down in the road and blocked the path of a Coca-Cola float before being removed by officers. Just Stop Oil had earlier urged organisers to stop taking sponsorship money from what it called high-polluting industries. A spokesperson for Pride in London, Will D.F. Morris, had this message for the activists.
Pride is a protest and Pride is a celebration, and we're protesting for LGBT plus rights and for our trans siblings who must never march alone. So for us, anyone who tries to disrupt that parade, it's really letting down those people that use this space once a year to come together and celebrate and protest for those rights. There are so many other opportunities during the year to share your messages. Please don't try and rain on this parade.
Will D.F. Morris. Still to come.
3, 2, 1.
Falcon 9 has successfully lifted off from pad 40 and throttled down to prepare for Max-Q.
A European space telescope has successfully blasted into orbit on a mission to understand mysterious phenomena known as dark matter and dark energy.
Who's your pick for the all-time greatest African goalkeeper? See if your choice made the list on Match of the Day, Africa Top 10.
Let's get into it.
Starting next week.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. The Dutch King Willem Alexander has apologised for the Netherlands' role in the global slave trade, calling it a horror.
On December the 19th last year, the Prime Minister apologised on behalf of the government for the fact that for centuries, human beings, in the name of the Dutch state, had been turned into commodities, had been exploited and mistreated. Today I stand before you as your king and as part of the government to say I am apologising myself.
The King was speaking at an event to mark the 160th anniversary of the abolition of slavery in the Dutch colonies. Among those attending were descendants of some of those who were enslaved. Coming after the Prime Minister's apology last year, I asked the Dutch journalist Anne Sonan just how significant this latest apology from the King was.
Yeah, I think this is hugely significant. I mean, this is the first country in the world, the first head of state who is openly and formally made his apology for the Dutch past in slavery.
And it's very personal to him, isn't it? Because the royal family in the Netherlands was involved in the global slave trade very early on, back in the 1600s.
Yes, it is. I mean, Holland obviously is a trading nation. In the last, I think about 5% of all slaves who have been traded worldwide was done by the Dutch. So about 500,000 slaves were traded in that time. And the Dutch government and the Dutch authorities were very heavily involved.
And the effects are still being felt today in the form of racism, and the King touched on that.
He did. He was very emotional about it, actually, and I think he's read a lot about it. He knows his history. The Dutch King is also very much a man of the people. He's he finds it very important to have a connection with the people and with the community of the Dutch Caribbean. You heard this loud applause after his apology, and I think he hit the right note, and I think a lot of, especially the Caribbean community, really appreciates what he said. I think, it was a very emotional moment.
They may appreciate what he said, even if this apology is very belated. But what about reparations? What's being done concretely to help the descendants of people who were enslaved?
Well, the Dutch government has already announced that they will not pay any reparations, not at this time. The Dutch government has promised 200 million euros towards projects that educate people about the Dutch slavery past, and the trade that happened hundreds of years ago. And the Dutch cabinet has also announced 27 million euro to build a new museum, a slave trade museum.
So is there any chance there could be reparations at some point in the future?
Not at this moment. I can't see that happening in the near future.
The Dutch journalist Anne Thanon. Australia has become the first country in the world to legalise the use of psychedelic drugs nationwide to treat some mental health conditions. From the 1st of July, approved psychiatrists can now prescribe MDMA, more commonly known as ecstasy when it's in tablet form, to those suffering post-traumatic stress disorder, and the psychedelic found in magic mushrooms for some types of depression. Our correspondent Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Psychedelic-assisted therapy is still in its infancy. Some experts believe MDMA and psilocybin have the power to transform the treatment of psychiatric disorders. Professor Susan Rossell is a researcher at Swinburne University. She's leading a clinical trial of psilocybin for patients with depression. She says the results so far are mixed.
We've been stuck for very many years in terms of mental health treatments for people with treatment-resistant conditions. So the fact that psychedelic medicines do seem to be working for a number of people is fantastic. However, they're not working for some people as well. And that's where I would note a great deal of caution in this field at the moment.
The psychedelic drugs must only be administered in a hospital or clinic. Two psychotherapists must stay with the patient for up to 8 hours to ensure their well-being. Professor Richard Harvey from the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Psychiatrists is worried psychedelic therapies will be too expensive and appointments hard to get.
We're in the midst of a mental health crisis. We have a shortage of psychiatrists. We have a shortage of psychologists. Where the resources, the time and the money to deliver this come from is, you know, somewhat unknown.
Other experts have insisted that Australia has rushed through the approval of feel-good chemicals and that the mental health of patients could be damaged even further. The country's medical regulator said the benefits to public health from psychedelic drugs outweigh the risks. Australia's experiment will be closely watched around the world.
Phil Mercer. The European Space Agency has launched a telescope into orbit that will make a huge 3D map of the cosmos. Euclid, which cost more than $1 billion, blasted off on a rocket from Cape Canaveral in Florida. It's hoped the project will help scientists solve some of the biggest mysteries of the universe, especially the phenomena known as dark matter and dark energy. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, reports.
3, 2, 1.
This is the moment the European Space Agency's Euclid spacecraft blasted off. It's got a 1 million mile journey ahead to get into position for its detailed survey of the sky. It will be studying what's known as the dark universe, which makes up 95% of the cosmos. Scientists think this consists of dark matter, ghost-like particles we can't see, and a mysterious force called dark energy. Ever since the Big Bang, the universe has been expanding, with galaxies moving ever further apart. But astronomers believe that dark energy is making this expansion speed up. Professor Mark McCorkran is from the European Space Agency.
One possibility is that dark energy is actually a fifth force, a new force in the universe that could enormously influence the fate of our universe. How far is it going to expand? Is it going to go forever and accelerate and just get bigger and bigger and bigger more rapidly? Is it going to just rip apart? Or will it perhaps collapse back down again? And understanding that fifth force, if that's what dark energy is, will help us understand, you know, not only where we came from, but where we're going in this universe.
It will take Euclid 6 years to make its cosmic map. Scientists say the wait will be worth it.
Rebecca Morell. Twitter's owner, Elon Musk, has announced temporary limits on the number of posts users can read each day. Mr. Musk said the move was aimed at tackling what he called extreme levels of data scraping and system manipulation. Throughout Saturday, people around the world have reported problems accessing Twitter. Rebecca Kesby spoke to Chris Stokel-Walker, a technology journalist, and asked him what exactly is going on.
Elon Musk has essentially decided he's had enough of people freeloading off Twitter. We have had, over the last few months, an increasing movement towards locking down public-facing websites and platforms like Twitter and Reddit, which is a similar sort of social network, which have been used to feed the large language models that power some of our powerful AI tools that we're kind of all obsessed with right now. And those tools have, according to Musk and others, been borrowing off the platforms for free, essentially training their models on the language that we use, and they need to pay up. So Musk has decided to instigate this to try and stop that scraping of data, although, you know, there are some people who believe that this is all a little bit of a ruse, and actually it's a case of him trying to just cut down costs for users more generally.
Well, yes, I mean, that's the suspicion among many Twitter users. I mean, it's fair to say, isn't it, that Elon Musk isn't that popular with many on Twitter. I saw today the hashtag #RestInPeaceTwitter was trending.
Yeah, almost a year now that he has been in control of the site after buying it over the odds for the stock price that it was selling at the time. And he has degraded the platform in many ways through getting rid of large numbers of staff to also refusing to pay bills for main functions like the web servers that operate Twitter. And there are some suspicions that perhaps this is one of those ways of trying to reduce the load on those servers. Essentially, if you limit the number of tweets that people can see, Musk initially said earlier this evening that it was going to be limited to 600 per day that you could see if you did not purchase a Twitter subscription, which costs between $8 to $11. If you did do that, then you would get 6,000. That's now changed to 800 and 8,000. So it does seem here like he is trying to negotiate a little bit against himself.
Very briefly, Chris, I mean, some people are saying Twitter's broken. Can it be restored to what it was before?
I think that there is still a chance, although it is notable that, you know, Musk has, in doing this, really turned off a lot of users. We have seen that this is kind of the final straw multiple times, but I think in actually limiting the ability for users to go on it, it really sort of turns them against it. And also, we have to bear in mind, he's trying to get advertisers here, and they need to know that their tweets will be seen. And with these limits, that's not possible.
Tech journalist Chris Stokel-Walker. Alia Days Ochoa was a founding member of the Buena Vista Social Club that in the late 1990s exported traditional Cuban music around the world. Made up of legendary Cuban musicians, their album was produced by the American musician Ray Cuda. It was also the subject of an award-winning documentary film. Now, at the age of 77, Alia Days Ochoa is bringing out a new album. It's called Guajiro, which in Cuba means someone who works the land. He talked to Martin Venard about it.
I wanted it to be an album that represented me because I am a Guajiro. I was born in the countryside in a place called Loma de la Avispa, up in the mountains in Santiago de Cuba. I have done 25 albums and I have done collaborations, but I wanted this album to represent me more than the other albums that I have done. That is why there are so many different types of rhythm in this album. There is a bolero song, but there are also guajira, guaracha, and son songs. And there are different instruments. It is different to what I have previously been doing. It is also more modern. I see many young people at the concerts that I do around the world, and young people sing the songs that I sing. I hope that this record is well received by my fans, and that it is the great prize that I wanted it to be, and that people like what I am doing. Doing this album helps keep me strong, young, and full of health. When I see the theaters where I perform and how full they are, that makes me feel good.
It
it's 27 years since you recorded the Buena Vista Social Club album. How did that change your life?
Mucho, mucho cambió la vida.
The Buena Vista Social Club project and album changed my life a lot. When we were working on Buena Vista Social Club, we did concerts, which were very well paid, and there was a lot of affection for us, and people recognized us. That was incredible. And the moment arrived when, even if I didn't ask for it, I felt like I was an ambassador for Cuban music. El cariño que te tengo, no te lo puedo negar. Se me sale la... When people talk about traditional Cuban music, about Cuban son, we have to thank the Buena Vista Social Club, which took our music to all corners of the world and all around the world. It was a project that nobody thought was going to happen, but it is still happening. So I'm very happy and very grateful to be a founding member of the gigantic project that was Buena Vista Social Club.
El proyecto gigante de Buena Vista Social Club.
Do you still see Ray Cuda, who produced the album?
Yes, I do see Ray Cuda. I haven't seen him recently, but I did see him a while ago. When the COVID pandemic happened, you couldn't go anywhere. But before that, I saw Ray Cuda. I went to see a concert by his son. I have maintained a friendship with Ray Cuda, which will last forever. The Buena Vista Social Club project was very difficult to pull off. But it happened. It was a dream come true.
Fue un sueño hecho realidad.
Would you like to do another Buena Vista Social Club album?
Bueno, lo que es...
Well, it would be a bit difficult to do another Buena Vista Social Club project. But if it happened, I would like to be a part of it.
Me gustaría.
Alié Day's Ochoa speaking to Martin Venard. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Rohan Madison. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Alan Kasuja from Africa Daily.
And I'm Audrey Brown from Focus on Africa.
Audrey, I'm delighted that your new podcast, Focus on Africa, is bringing our listeners even more great coverage about our continent from the BBC World Service.
Thank you so much, Alan. And you know, I'm already a fan of your podcast. Africa Daily is every weekday morning. Wake up to one big question, one story from Africa, for Africa.
Exactly, Audrey. And every weekday afternoon, Focus on Africa explores three important stories affecting Africa. And you get the African perspective on global stories too.
So, wake up with an in-depth look into one big story with Alan on Africa Daily.
And wind down at the end of the day with Audrey and three essential stories on Focus on Africa.
Search for Focus on Africa.
And Africa Daily.
Wherever you get your BBC podcasts.